Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as a tour of the battle space of the war for the free world. And I am really thrilled to have someone who has contributed mightily to that war in a number of different capacities. Earlier on, as a special operations veteran in the United States Army's 3rd Ranger Battalion and then in its 5th Special Forces Group. Now as the managing editor of SOFREP and as the author of a very interesting and important new book, Benghazi, The Definitive Report, which he co-authored with another special operator, Brandon Webb. It's great to have you with us. His name, of course, is Jack Murphy. Jack, thanks so much for taking the time to discuss your book and some of the insights that come from it.
Oh, well, thanks for having me on the show, Frank.
Many, many questions still remain to be answered. You have posed information that in some ways begs more questions in a way than satisfies some of us as questioners. I was among those, Jack, who we pulled together last week to ask for a select bicameral committee in this the Congress to do some deeper drill down on it, and I think at the very least it will be necessary for further investigations to be informed by some of your insights, and I just wanted to go through some of the things that you've learned, that you've posited, that you've reported on, that for example would cry out for further examination. Let's start with sort of what was going on in Benghazi to begin with. Why was it that the ambassador, Christopher Stevens, was there with all of the security problems on that day of all days, September 11th?
Well, there's a lot going on in Benghazi. And to really understand the historical context of what happened in Benghazi, you definitely have to look backwards in time and understand, as Chris Stevens understood very well, that Benghazi was a center of gravity for Islamic extremism and a place where traditionally jihadists and terrorists had come from. And this was something that Stevens knew very well from his first stint in Libya in 2006 and 2007. And he actually wrote a series of cables, which were subsequently leaked through WikiLeaks. And when you read these cables, it gives you really a good understanding of what was happening in Benghazi and Derna as far as the Islamic extremism and the terrorism. But it also gives you a really good insight into Chris Stevens as a person and who he was. He's a very sharp guy who understood the region very well. So I think that's really why Chris was in Benghazi and why Chris was pushing to have Benghazi. You know, one of the things that we confuse in the media is that consulate in Benghazi wasn't actually a consulate. It was actually a temporary mission facility. And Chris was pushing hard to have it actually designated as an official consulate because he knew how important Benghazi was, how politically important it was, and how important it was going to be for America to engage with the people in Benghazi.
Okay, it's a center of gravity in Benghazi. Chris Stevens understood it as such. And yet there was something else going on, at least as you've reported, in the form of a sort of clandestine operation that was seemingly being run, as I understand it, by John Brennan, the man that President Obama would like to have be the next director of the Central Intelligence Agency. Tell us about that.
Yeah, well, there was a number of different covert operations being run inside Benghazi and around that area. The State Department, of course, was engaged in diplomacy. The CIA was nearby in the annex running their own operations, trying to track down fissile material that was left over after the Libyan Civil War. But aside from all of that, there was another operation, another series of operations, which were being run by Joint Special Operations Command. So it was U.S. military special operations going into Libya and conducting covert operations that targeted an al-Qaeda personality one of the last high-level al-Qaeda personalities named al-Suri, but also targeting the weapons caches that the militias had come into the possession of after the Civil War. And now that the war's over, you know, we don't want these types of weapons, military-grade weapons, in the hands of militias and terrorist organizations, which some of which are even affiliated with al-Qaeda. So these operations were being kept compartmentalized to the point that Chris Stevens and the State Department mission didn't know what was going on. But likewise, General Petraeus and the CIA mission in Benghazi didn't know what was going on. So that's how much security there was around these operations. And John Brennan
did know what was going on. John Brennan was actually calling the shots on this thing from the White House.
That's correct. That John Brennan authorized it. He wasn't leading per se, but he authorized the operations and he knew all about them.
Wow. Jack Murphy is our guest. He is the co-author of Benghazi, the Definitive Report. And the other piece of this which nags at me, Jack, and I just wonder if you've got an explanation for it, is that there have been some rumors that Stevens, who, as you know, the ambassador, when he was, I guess, the deputy chief of mission, was given the assignment of getting some arms into the hands of the very people that ultimately proved to be so problematic in Benghazi, among others. And he's meeting the night of this attack, the very last official act he has. In fact, I guess probably the last act of his life was meeting with the Turkish consul general. And Fox News, among others, has reported, as you know, that there was a shipment of arms on a Libyan vessel that went into Turkey near the Syrian border. It sure looks as though somebody was running arms into the Syrian rebels. And as you say, among those in the jihadist camp, al-Qaeda elements. What do we know, if anything, about what Stevens might have been doing with the Turkish consul general on that count?
Well, I think everything you said, everything you mentioned is actually correct, but I think that the information leads one to connect some dots that aren't necessarily connected. Just for instance, I'll just start off or preface this by saying that, yes, there is a weapons trafficking program from Libya to Syria. However, Chris Stevens and the State Department mission, as well as the CIA mission there in Benghazi, were not involved in that. So I just want to be clear about that. What Stevens
and you and you know
about,
that because?
Because there's a number of reasons. Just on the surface, you can. Chris was a foreign service guy, so it wouldn't make any sense for him to be trafficking weapons. And I think that Chris would be ideologically opposed to such activities. But
Jack, just let me interrupt you, just real quick, just on that point, if I may, just real quick. Was he not involved as a State Department official getting arms to the Libyans for the purposes of overthrowing Muammar Gaddafi?
No, he was there to engage with the rebels. I mean, that's just a fact. He was diplomatically engaged with the rebels during the war. And if there was any facilitation of weapons into rebel hands, someone like Chris would have had the role of vetting them to see which ones we can work with and which we can't, and as far as which are al-Qaeda affiliated groups and which aren't. But he would not be the person facilitating weapons into the rebel hands. And frankly, the rebels captured so much arms from the Gaddafi regime, from Gaddafi stockpiles, that I really don't feel there is any need for us to funnel weapons to the rebels during the Libyan civil war. However, when we start talking about the Syrian civil war, we're getting into somewhat of a separate issue in that, yes, we are supplying them with weapons, but that's sort of a separate program, and no, Chris Stevens wouldn't have been a part of that.
This is a really interesting subject, and I think that probably on the basis of what you've said and on the basis of what you've reported, Jack Murphy, in your new book, Benghazi, the Definitive Report, there's lots of room for inquiries. Charlotte Atkinson of CBS has offered a whole series of questions that I'm heartened to see somebody in the mainstream press asking, and a number of them that that you've posed as well that remain unanswered. This is a moment when it seems to me, especially as we seem to be getting embroiled in another really viper's nest in Syria, that we have a clarity about what we're doing, who's doing it, on whose authority, the sort of thing that Congress is supposed to be doing, it seems to me. And Jack, I appreciate so much what you and Brendan have done to help get these issues squarely in front of the public and their elected representatives again. And I hope you'll come back to us to talk about them more. I know we're out of time now, but very much enjoyed it and look forward to visiting with you in the near future. Next up, Michael Davidson, a former clandestine CIA officer, will talk to us about Benghazi and Russia. What's going on with that? Straight ahead.
Know what you think. Leave your comments at 1-800-332-7131.
If you're a veteran of Iraq or Afghanistan, like me, coming home can be harder than expected. I felt a little out of place, but it turns out I wasn't alone. At IAVA.org, there's a free online community of thousands of OIF and OEF vets who've got your back here, just like they did over there. So now, I'm never alone. I can get the resources I need and talk to tons of people who understand where I'm coming from.
Whether it's navigating the GI Bill
or VA hospitals,
managing the transition home,
or meeting people you can share stories with,
you'll find it at IAVA.org.
Even if it's just everyday stuff,
like getting tips on where to find a nice sweater for my dog.
Did he just say that?
Really? What?
Okay, maybe not that, but everything else. No matter where you are, Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America is there for you. Join our community at IAVA.org.
We've got your back.
Brought to you by Iraq Afghanistan Veterans of America and the Ad Council.
The first step in winning a war is to know whom you're fighting. 9 years after 9/11, the U.S. security establishment has failed to tell us. The very words we need to describe the war are being outlawed. We went from the war on terror under Bush to the war on man-made disasters under Obama. Neither identifies the threat doctrine behind the aggression, Islamic Sharia law. That's why the Center for Security Policy assembled Team B, an independent group of national security professionals, including Bill Clinton's Director of Central Intelligence, James Woolsey. The result is a book that challenges the assumptions of the current administration and exposes the supremacist nature of Sharia and the jihad its adherents are obliged to engage in. This report names the names of those responsible and makes plain the mortal peril now posed to America's Constitution, our national security, and way of life. For more information, visit ShariaTheThreat.com or order your copy of Sharia, The Threat to America at Amazon.com.
Experts say there's no shortage of crude oil.
There really is no shortage of oil at the moment.
So why do gasoline prices keep going up?
There's all this fear that's out there, and that really goes a long way to making prices go up.
And home prices seem to be headed even lower.
We really aren't seeing any markets that are showing any sustained recovery at this point.
Now more than ever, is this a timeout or a double dip?
It could halt the economy's recovery in its tracks.
1260 WRC. New choice, intelligent talk.
You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. We're joined once again by Michael Davidson. He is the author, most recently, of a terrific book, Incubus, and prior to that, Harry's Rules. These are born of his experience some 28 years as a CIA clandestine services officer, and he spent much of his time waging the Cold War against the Soviet Union and the Warsaw Pact. We've had the privilege of talking with him before about some of that area of previous responsibility, and I want to come to that before we're done. But, Michael, I'd like to pick up on something that I was just discussing with Jack Murphy about his book about Benghazi and the definitive report, as he calls it. And specifically, I wanted to get sort of your reading as a former covert operative of how plausible is the thesis of his book, namely that John Brennan could have been running out of the White House with obviously the president's authority, but in a very, very closely held way, some kind of gun running operation that might in fact have involved arms shipments into Syria.
Well, I read Murphy's book. I found it very informative. I found that it coincided in most parts with sort of a background report that I had been given several months ago, right after the Benghazi tragedy. I think it's perfectly plausible, and I think that Murphy's sources are probably excellent, that Brennan was running these off-the-books operations without coordination with either the intelligence community or the State Department, and this would certainly have put the ambassador in jeopardy.
Mm. And to the extent that he was, one of the issues that I came up somewhat head-to-head with Jack on was the plausibility of Chris Stevens having been completely cut out of something like this. And you know, if he were, you're absolutely right, it would have put him in jeopardy. But I'm wondering whether there wasn't something in the fact that he felt constrained to be in Benghazi on September 11th, meeting with, of all people, the Turkish consul general late into the evening, that suggested there was something else going on here.
Well, you've hit smack dab onto one of my main concerns about this entire episode. Why in the world would the ambassador have traveled to a dangerous, known dangerous spot like Benghazi, practically unguarded on a date like 9/11? And why exactly was he meeting with the Turkish consul general late into the evening? I think that this would have probably, Frank, less to do with whatever Brennan might have been mucking about with in Libya than with what the CIA might have been doing with its post, the so-called annex in Benghazi. That was a very large, as my understanding, a very large post. Had over 30 people in it, including the global response people, the ex-Navy SEALs, etc., which would have made it one of the largest CIA posts in the entire region. And the indications I'm getting is that they were there for a couple of reasons. One, there was a great fear that Gaddafi had retained some yellow cake in the country, and they were desperately trying to find it before it fell into jihadist hands. And also they were monitoring the arms flow out of Benghazi and western Egypt to the opposition in Syria. Now, it's fairly, I think, well accepted these days that Benghazi had become a main point of a collection of radical jihadists from North Africa and the shipment of these illicit arms via Turkey into Syria to the rebels there. This, of course, would have been of great concern to not only the Syrians, but to the Russians, who are, along with the Iranians, the main support that Assad has these days.
Indeed. And so this is really the piece of it that puzzles me, as you say, and what role were the Turks playing in such shipments? And could it have been the case that the ambassador was frantically trying to get do damage control, really, on an important operation that had come a cropper that he was aware of, to some extent at least, and that could have had very profound political consequences for John Brennan's boss, the President of the United States? We may not know the answer. We certainly won't unless the Congress gets engaged on this and does its due diligence. And I'm prayerful that they will do that, Michael Davidson. Let me switch gears, if I can, to take advantage of your expertise on the Russian portfolio. We talked a bit about what it might have been up to in all of this. But more broadly, Michael, talk to us about what Russia is like these days. Is it fair to say that when the Soviet Union collapsed, it reorganized, but as you put it in your book, Harry's Rules, the Cold War did not end?
Yes. I think the Cold War died out for a while. But if you look at what the Russians have done since Putin consolidated power there, certainly they are they view us in an inimical manner, and I think they're doing all they can to create problems for us. You know, like a pack of wolves, to use an unfortunate analogy. The Russians sense weakness, and they're taking advantage of it. American foreign policy has been severely damaged over the past 4 years. We're in a weaker position almost everywhere in the world. Our military is unfortunately suffering greatly. We have we're exiting from Afghanistan before the job is done. It's going to be another one of those episodes like at the end of the Vietnam War when a Democratic Congress cut the legs out from under the South Vietnamese and allowed the North Vietnamese to overcome that country. It's an unfortunate, almost a tradition these days in American foreign policy that we'll wind something up and then suddenly the opposition political party will wind them down before anything can actually be accomplished. So, yes, the Russians do oppose us. The Russians are arming Iran to the teeth. They've provided them with the latest iteration of anti-aircraft defenses, which will make it very difficult for either us or the Israelis to go in there to take care of their nuclear capabilities, which have been aided all along by the Russians, especially the operation of the Bushehr reactor. And, of course, they have long been allies of the Assad regime, both father and son. And Syria is simply too important to the Russians for them to allow Assad to fall. So I get the impression these days that the tide may be turning in Syria in favor of the regime. I understand that the radical jihadists are leaving Syria, heading for places like Mali, where they think they can be more effective. And I think within the next couple of months we're going to see that situation resolve one way or the other, probably to the advantage of Russia and Iran.
Wow. Interesting and certainly contrary to most of the reporting, I think, at the moment. But this is what we turn to you for, Michael Davidson, is some insights that that may be true, but not necessarily
one thing in the common knowledge. One thing that people simply do not seem to understand is that Assad is an Alawite. You know, in other countries, people have places they can go outside of their own countries. The Alawites have no place other than in Syria, so they're going to make their stand, and they're either going to win there or they're going to die there. That is my opinion.
There's been some speculation that they might carve out an enclave that they could continue to live in, but I think you're absolutely right. Their back is against the wall, and I think to some extent the Iranians feel the same way, and therefore this is a fight to the death. We'll be following it closely. I hope with your good help, Michael Davidson, career clandestine services officer in the CIA, a man who has contributed both in that respect and certainly in our thinking and understanding of these two terrific books, Harry's Rules, and most recently, Incubus. Michael, we'll talk with you again soon. Next up, Dr. Barry Rubin joins us with another perspective on the Middle East and the Kerry and Obama roadshows there. Straight ahead.
To securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
It is with sound mind and body that I, James Fredericks III, after fighting with all direct family members for decades, leave my entire fortune of $32 million to the one friend I had in the end, the package delivery guy, Matt Songer.
Woohoo! Yeah! I had a feeling about this. Uh-huh! I'm rich! Oh, this cannot be happening.
Actually, it's not happening.
What?
And it never will.
I don't get it.
There aren't even people here. That's just one of those murmuring sound effects.
Seriously?
Listen, if you want to have money in your future, don't rely on luck.
Huh.
Put $10 away each month. Cook once in a while instead of eating out.
Okay.
Pay down your high-interest credit cards.
Right.
Small changes today, big bucks tomorrow.
So, no inheritance?
No. Go to feedthepig.org for more free ideas.
Feedthepig.org.
This message brought to you by the American Institute of Certified Public Accountants and the Ad Council.
And just to be clear, no inheritance, right?
This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. President Obama wants John Brennan to run the Central Intelligence Agency, but as Congressman Trent Franks put it recently, Brennan should not be allowed near the CIA, let alone be put in charge of it, because he doesn't understand the danger posed by self-described jihadists. Notably, in May 2010, John Brennan insisted that, quote, jihad is a holy struggle, a legitimate tenet of Islam, meaning to purify oneself or one's community, unquote. Islamists or their apologists say such things in order to confuse us or get us to lower our guard. It's simply not true. Jihad is holy war, period. And to entrust the CIA to someone who gets this fundamental issue so wrong is to invite our destruction at the hands of enemies that have no illusion about their duty to destroy us. This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Learn more at securefreedom.org.
The Devil We Don't Know by Noni Darwish uncovers the dark side of revolution in the Middle East and the reason why Muslim countries are unable to dig themselves out of a cycle of revolution, political unrest, and tyranny. The constitutions of many Muslim countries state that Sharia law supersedes all other law, and that is why it has failed in providing a legal and political system where healthy democracy can flourish. In this dynamic, only tyrannical governments can survive. In The Devil We Don't Know, human rights activist and Center for Security Policy fellow Noni Darwish answers the tough questions. Why the Arab Spring won't usher in freedom and democracy or a feminist movement. And how Israel will be threatened by the new wave of Islamism after the so-called Arab Spring. The Devil We Don't Know by Noni Darwish. It's available at Amazon.com.
America's injured and critically ill service members face incredible challenges every day of their lives. Since 2004, the Semper Fi Fund has helped thousands of service members and their families with both immediate and long-term needs. Join the Semper Fi Fund in supporting American heroes. They've given so much. Now it's our turn. Learn how your tax-deductible donation makes a real difference in their lives at SemperFiFund.org.
I'm a champion, realize Shaq's mechanism.
Hi, Shaquille O'Neal for Rad. This is not your normal PSA. Don't be stupid. Don't drink and drive. If you're going to go out and have a good time, it's fine. But designate a driver to drive home. Let's stop the madness. Don't drink and drive.
Public service announcement brought to you by the U.S. Department of Transportation, RAD, the National Association of Broadcasters, and the Ad Council.
Hi, this is Frank Effney. You're listening to Intelligent Talk on WRC 1260 in Washington, D.C.
Now more with Frank Effney.
Welcome back. We're joined by Dr. Barry Rubin, one of the folks that we turn to with great regularity. I'm happy to say he's always very accommodating. He hails from the state of Israel, where he is the director of the Gloria Center, the Global Research and International Affairs Center of the Interdisciplinary Center at Herzliya. He is the author of numerous important works, including most recently Israel, An Introduction, and he literally wrote the book on the Muslim Brotherhood. It's called The Muslim Brotherhood, The Organization and Policies of a Global Islamist Movement. Dr. Rubin, great to have you with us. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
We're, of course, interested in getting your take on the marvelous adventures of the new Secretary of State, John Kerry, as he has been running about your neighborhood. Let's go through a couple of the low points of his travels. Shortly before he arrived, the Prime Minister of Turkey, Recep Erdogan, made a rather provocative statement in Vienna about which the Secretary felt constrained to say tut tut. What did you make of the statement, and what was the adequacy of the U.S. response to it?
Look, the key issue here, I mean, we know that Erdogan is an Islamist and he's a radical, even though he uses far more subtle forms than the Muslim Brotherhood. But the most incredibly shocking thing, if we didn't have so many incredibly shocking things to think about, is that he is President Obama's favorite Middle East leader, who he constantly praises. Now, think, here's a guy who made a huge anti-Semitic remark, who has turned a very sharply antagonistic against Israel to the point that the opposition leader said about a year ago that he wants to go to war with Israel, who is imposing Islamism on Turkey. And this is Obama's favorite Middle East leader, and Obama doesn't feel the need to move away from that. It sort of shows us just how bizarre the circumstances we're in and how extreme the administration's pro-Islamist policy is.
Yeah. It's worse in a way than that. Of course, the statement was that he equated Zionism with Nazism and fascism and described it as a crime against humanity. And what President Obama has indicated, as I understand it, Barry Rubin, is that he thinks that the model that Recep Erdogan has imposed on Turkey is one that really should be encouraged and replicated elsewhere.
Absolutely. But I want to say something extremely important about media coverage and the international affairs debate. Erdogan says things like this three times a week, four times a week. The only difference is it was covered. If you follow the Turkish press daily, you just see statement after statement. This is 1/30th of what's going on. By the way, the same thing applies for the Muslim Brotherhood and for the Palestinian Authority and for others. Every once in a while, some outrageous statement makes it into Western media. There are constantly outrageous statements. Just because they're not reported doesn't mean they don't exist.
Yeah. And on that point...
Obama said that, Erdogan was giving Obama advice on raising his daughters. So we wonder if this advice includes becoming anti-Semite.
Yeah, and certainly wearing head coverings. Let me ask you, Barry Rubin, apropos that point, we've got Turkey engaging in this kind of stuff all the time, as you're saying. It doesn't get covered much, but it's happening. Similarly, in Egypt, where Secretary Kerry also made a visit and promised more aid to a government that is led by Mohamed Morsi, whose anti-Semitic remarks were picked up by the press very late in the day, mind you, but nonetheless picked up. At what point does it suggest to the sentient being, just the man in the street with a modicum of common sense, that maybe we are helping the wrong people?
Well, the man in the street in what country? In the U.S., if it's not reported, people don't know about it. And again, by the way, every day, without exception, the Muslim Brotherhood makes, in its media, on its Arabic website, makes statements like this. And they're not reported, in part, because reporters who are covering Egypt decide they don't want to report them because they don't want to make the Brotherhood look bad. Now, the interesting thing now is that the U.S. looks very bad to the other side. The opposition, which is now formed a group called the National Salvation Front, has, number one, decided not to meet with Kerry because it said Kerry is supporting the regime. In fact, in one of the counter-demonstrators to Kerry's visit, Kerry had a sign saying the U.S. wants to make Egypt like Pakistan, and they don't want that. And number two, it says it's going to boycott the election on March 22nd. And I need to say something here. It's extraordinarily important. On March 22nd, Egypt will hold elections for its parliament. And people will be told in the West that this is going to weaken Islamists. This is not accurate. What is probably going to happen, it's one of two things. Either, number one, the Muslim Brotherhood will become more dependent on the even more radical Salafists to get a majority in parliament, meaning that the Egyptian regime is going to be more radical. The second option is that if the moderates follow through on their official position that they're going to boycott the election, and it's 6 weeks from now, so they better decide soon, but their position is they're going to boycott the election, then something like 80 or 90% of members of parliament are going to be radical Islamists. So Egypt is, in fact, about to get much worse. Now,
and we're sending it aid.
Unconditional aid. And also at a time of massive demonstrations of the killing of over 500 people by the security forces. So I said, there's no reason why the aid couldn't be postponed for 2 months, 3 months, see how the election goes. I mean, no matter how pro-Islamist and pro-Muslim Brotherhood the U.S. government's policy under Obama seems to be, over time it becomes more so, which brings us to the third example, which is Syria. Now, the debate in the U.S. has been, should the U.S. give direct aid to the rebels? Shouldn't the U.S. give direct aid to the rebels? Well, that's not the issue. The issue is, should the United States give guns to Salafist groups and the Muslim Brotherhood, which guns will be used after the civil war ends to kill Christians and Alawites and to use against Israel and to perhaps use against the United States. Is that the policy that's going to benefit U.S. interests? Now, the alternative is, of course, to give the guns more of the moderate forces. But my colleague, Dr. Jonathan Speier, who just returned from his third trip to Syria, has reached the conclusion that I've also reached, which is it's too late. I think we're at the point that we can understand that when the Syrian government is overthrown, we're talking perhaps a year off or a bit more, I think it's too late to have a moderate regime. It's going to be an Islamist regime. And the idea that people are debating hotly whether or not the U.S. should give guns to the Syrian opposition is not the right issue. The issue is, who are the guns going to go to? Those guns are going to go to Salafist groups and the Muslim Brotherhood. And after the civil war is over, they're going to be used to impose a dictatorship on Syria. They're going to be used to possibly to massacre Alawites and Christians. They're going to be used against Israel and possibly against the West. It wasn't so long ago that the issue of arms supply to Libya provided, first of all, a lot of arms for terrorists in the Gaza Strip. And, of course, the Benghazi incident, which was very tied up with that. No lesson has been learned from this experience.
None whatsoever.
It never ceases to amaze me.
Yeah, none whatsoever. In fact, we talked about it earlier in the program, and I think we're at very grave risk of repeating the error. Barry, very quickly, is there a dime's worth of difference, really, between the Salafists and the Muslim Brotherhood in terms of their
Absolutely.
Agenda?
Well, the difference is that the Muslim Brotherhood is a Salafist group, so it's somewhat misleading. But the Salafists want to go faster, and they want to go further. For example, the Muslim Brotherhood wrote the Constitution with the support of significant numbers of Salafists to be subtle and not push it in people's face that they want a Sharia regime. Some of the other Salafists weren't happy with that. The Muslim Brotherhood, many of the Salafists are ready to borrow money from the IMF and get money from the West. Most extreme Salafists reject that. I think on a question of blundering into war with Israel, I think there is an important difference. I think the Muslim Brotherhood would be more cautious than the Salafists. So there are important differences, but of course, they're nowhere near as far big as they are made to be. But the Obama administration, one of the main rationales for supporting the Muslim Brotherhood is that it will restrain the Salafists. And that's true in sense of timing. But the fact is that the Muslim Brotherhood uses the Salafists. They have a situation of attacks on churches. Muslim Brotherhood and Salafist cadre both participate in demonstrations and attacking construction. It's a total error to see the Muslim Brotherhood as the good guys, but there are some important differences.
Yeah, but my own feeling about it, Barry, is that there are differences of tactics and timing, really, rather than the goals or even necessarily the trajectory they want to get us along. But speaking of trajectory, we have to get along, Barry. I have to let you go. Thank you so much for joining us and for your insights. Dr. Barry Rubin, author most recently of Israel, An Introduction. Keep up the great work. We'll look forward to talking with you soon. Next up, we've got Gordon Chang talking about Chinese arms getting into this mix. Straight ahead.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
I went from a size 18 down to a size 5, and I was able to keep it off.
Angie had some serious challenges.
I had gone through a divorce and put on quite a bit of weight. There was an accident where I was put on a lot of medication, and I put on over 60 pounds. I tried every kind of diet, but diets just did not work.
Diets don't work is something they hear a lot over at the MetaSystem from Judy Singer.
I heard about Judy Singer's MetaSystem, and I thought, well, you know, couldn't hurt to call, and I called them up, and they told me all about the product, and I thought, well, I'll give it a try. From the first week that I was on it, I wasn't hungry a lot, and it was just amazing. Jumping about 3 months ahead, I dropped 63 pounds.
If you're ready for a natural product that cleanses your system and helps you lose fat, talk to a Judy Singer counselor about the MetaSystem. Call 1-800-711-JUDY. 1-800-711-JUDY. The MetaSystem from Judy Singer. Powerful, all-natural weight loss. 1-800-711-JUDY.
Hi. This is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real special forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real special forces, ours need ammunition. And in the war of ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its special forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
If your walls could talk, what would they say?
I have held the same mirror for 13 years.
I have been decorated with purple dinosaurs, baseball teams, and football helmets.
I have witnessed 33 Thanksgiving dinners and one wedding proposal.
I have tiny notches marking the growth of three children.
I have caused a learning disability.
I am the reason that a fifth grader simply can't sit still.
I am responsible for a five-year-old's rage.
Just because you can't see lead paint doesn't mean it's not on walls, doors, windows, and sills. Today, lead paint poisoning affects over 1 million children. If your home is built before 1978, your family could be at risk. Let's make all kids lead-free kids. Log on to leadfreekids.org or call 800-424-LEAD.
I am the reason a child has trouble hearing.
If your walls could talk, what would they say?
Brought to you by the Coalition to End Childhood Lead Poisoning, EPA, HUD, and the Ad Council.
Dennis Prager thinks there should be a simple standard to textbooks.
I'll tell you how I think a textbook should be written. This is what happened, period.
That is the role of the text.
And if nearly everybody who did something important in American history, if 78.9% of them were WASP males, then I want 78.9% of the textbook to reflect that fact.
I care about truth.
That's why I'm not on the left.
The Dennis Prager Show.
Up in the morning and out to school.
Weeknights at 10 on 1260 WRC. New Choice, Intelligent Talk.
If you're a veteran of Iraq or Afghanistan, like me, coming home can be harder than expected. I felt a little out of place, but it turns out I wasn't alone.
At IAVA.org, there's a free online community of thousands of OIF and OEF vets who've got your back here, just like they did over there.
So now, I'm never alone. I can get the resources I need and talk to tons of people who understand where I'm coming from.
Whether it's navigating the GI Bill
or VA hospitals,
managing the transition home, or meeting people you can share stories with,
you'll find it at IAVA.org.
Even if it's just everyday stuff.
Like getting tips on where to find a nice sweater for my dog.
Did he just say that?
Really? What?
Okay, maybe not that, but everything else. No matter where you are, Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America is there for you. Join our community at IAVA.org.
We've got your back.
Brought to you by Iraq Afghanistan Veterans of America and the Ad Council.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. One of the features of this program is our regular visit with Gordon Chang, the country's preeminent expert, as far as I'm concerned, on Asia and the U.S. interests in that region, especially as they are increasingly at risk as a result of a rising China. Gordon, it's always great to have you with us. Thanks for taking a few minutes.
Thank you so much, Frank.
We had a very important and ominous development recently with a dhow, as I believe they call them, that was intercepted off of Iranian waters headed towards Yemen with advanced Chinese-manufactured man-portable air defenses, or man-pads. What's that about? And do we expect the Chinese arms to be turning up in greater numbers and with ominous effect in there and elsewhere?
In January, the U.S. Navy intercepted this Iranian dhow, which had on it a lot of ammunition going to rebels in northwest Yemen. The most important seizure were 10 man pads, which were Chinese in origin. This is important for two reasons. One of them is that recently Chinese man pads have been showing up all over the world. Up until about the middle of last decade, China was very careful not to let its client states allow the transfer of man pads to non-state actors. But what we saw around 2005, 2006 or so were the Chinese man pads were showing up in Afghanistan, courtesy of Iran. And so these were being used to kill American servicemen. We saw them with insurgents in Iraq, also courtesy of Iran. And recently, in the last year or so, Chinese manpads have been showing up in a Burmese private army. They've been showing up Syrian rebels. This was clear because it ended up on Chinese state television. And now this disclosure of Chinese manpads going to Yemen. These are very dangerous weapons because they can bring down civilian airliners. You bring down the first civilian airliner, there goes the global economy.
Right. And obviously they would also pose an increasingly sophisticated threat to even military aircraft, which can have very direct implications, as you say, for our servicemen and women's lives and for the missions that they're performing. And Gordon, one of the things that we always are told when we have a conversation like this is, not with you so much, but with others, is, well, it's not clear that the Chinese government knows what's being done or is authorizing what's being done. You indicated in your earlier comments that they've been exercising control in the past. Is their control simply breaking down, or do you think the Chinese now find it convenient for their political purposes to have these weapons migrating into such non-state actors' hands?
This is clearly a decision made at the highest levels of the Chinese government. First of all, these man pads are manufactured by a state-owned enterprise. This is not some guys in a garage making sophisticated weapons. This is a Chinese state-owned entity controlled by Beijing doing this. These types of leakages of sophisticated arms don't happen without people in Beijing knowing about it. And the Syrian rebels, these were shown on CCTV 13. This is China state television with images of Syrian rebels with a very new model of a Chinese manpad, an FN6. There are virtually no FN6s on the black market, if there are any at all. And so clearly this had to come from a Chinese state enterprise acting with the authority of Beijing, because you just couldn't do this.
So as with the Chinese hacking that is now increasingly, I think, clearly associated with the government of China making the decision to have this sort of thing happen, we're seeing these weapons transitioning into these unfriendly hands with their direct involvement and assent. Chilling, to say the least. Gordon, at your Forbes.com column, you reported on some developments that are suggesting a further giant stride, perhaps, towards the crash that you've been anticipating for some time and attendant collapse of China. Tell us what's happened and what some of the early ripple effects have been.
China's State Council, which is the cabinet, a couple days ago issued guidelines, a statement on tightening property prices in China. There are property curbs that already exist. They haven't been enforced. The State Council wants them enforced. And also, it's going to ramp up some of these tightening measures. This is a result of China's bull run in property, which has made residential real estate in the cities unaffordable to all but the wealthiest Chinese. The Chinese state government wants to make it make property available to others. And so they're now trying to reverse the process of these very big increases in property prices. This has had the first knock-on effect was the Chinese stock markets tumbled last night, fell 3.7% in Shanghai. We're going to see more of this because right now China is at a very delicate point. The economy is fragile, and measures intended to stop these asset bubbles are going to ripple through the entire economy as well. So we're going to see, I think, more stories like this. And it's going to be very difficult for China's new leadership, which takes over in a few days with Li Keqiang becoming the new premier. It's going to be very difficult for them to be able to control property prices and yet maintain economic growth.
And we are seeing increasing evidence, I guess, of the turmoil that is contributing to, or at least is being exacerbated by, in many of the rural areas particularly. Gordon, again, is our weekly visitor on matters involving Asia and the Far East. He is also the duty expert on these subjects for Forbes.com, WorldAffairsJournal.com, and, of course, Fox News. Gordon Chang, let me talk to you about one other matter that happened last week. I was sort of surprised that it didn't seem to get more attention. Maybe I just missed it, but the Prime Minister of Japan was in town. How did that meeting go, and what does it suggest about the state of U.S.-Japanese relations?
Yeah. Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe was in town for his first foreign trip after becoming Prime Minister. This was a low-key visit. There was no state dinner. There was a lunch. Michelle Obama blew off Abe's wife, saying she was too busy, so Abe's wife did not come. This is a problem because the president also did not give a strong rhetorical endorsement of the U.S.-Japan Mutual Security Treaty. And that, the reason that's important is because the Chinese are trying to take islands that are administered by Japan in the East China Sea, the Senkakus, as the Japanese call them. Secretary Clinton, to her credit, was very strong on this issue, and she pushed back against the Chinese. The Chinese state media said that was just so happy that Obama was restrained. But one thing that's really important is that the way the Chinese paid back the president's restraint on this was to have more incursions into Japanese territorial waters around the islands. So, which means you can't be nice to the Chinese these days, because they see that as a sign of weakness and they therefore press their advantage. This is perhaps the most dangerous spot on earth. And so the president needs to be stronger, make it very clear that the United States will defend Japanese territory. If we don't do that, we're going to see a replay of the 1939 dynamic.
Wow. Gordon, we were talking about this same problem with Michael Davidson in an earlier segment, where adversaries or perhaps enemies of this country or both are perceiving weakness from the Obama administration, and that does in fact beget a more aggressive policy on their part. This certainly seems to be the case in the instance you're talking about here. Is there any chance that the president simply neglected this, or was it a matter of calculation? Despite his talk about a pivot to Asia and concerns, at least sotto voce, about China's rise being a problem, is the president in fact signaling a kind of long-distance kowtow to the Chinese?
I'm afraid that President Obama just miscomprehends the Chinese. And, you know, Secretary Clinton had a pretty hard-line view on the Chinese towards the end of her tenure. But that's because they humiliated her in the beginning of her tenure, where she tried to signal cooperation with them, and they just made it very clear that they did not want to cooperate with her. We're going to see the same thing with Secretary Kerry, who's just going to try to cooperate with Beijing, but Beijing won't cooperate with Kerry. Unfortunately, the administration does not know how to deal with the Chinese, and this is unforgivable because they already went through this in the first term. You can't make this stuff up, Frank.
Right. The old line about fool me once, shame on you. Fool me twice, shame on me. Gordon Chang, we have to leave it at that. Thank you very much, as always, for visiting with us about the really important dynamic. And God forbid that it's reminiscent, as you say, of the lead up to World War II. But if it is, we'll be covering it closely here, needless to say. And thank you for your efforts. Thanks to all of you for being with us. I hope you'll join us again tomorrow, as Gordon will next week. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.